Hello and welcome to The Hardy Brain, the show that takes athletic, introverted entrepreneurs and leaders and transforms them into ironclad brain performers. I'm your host, Dr. David Hardy. And today we've got another amazing guest on our show. She is a Stanford digital well-being educator, the author of two books, Mindful by Design and Designing Wonderful, and is the founder of MindWise. Welcome to the show, Caitlin Krause. How are you doing today?
Thank you, Dr. Dave. I don't know if I should say Dr. Dave or Dave. I am doing wonderfully. I'm even better now. I've been looking forward to this talk for a while.
Yeah, this is exciting, and it is so good to have you on the show. Now, you've worked with organizations, universities, individuals worldwide, from Stanford to Meta to the U.S. State Department, and, well, what type of new world are you trying to create?
You know, I think that when you bring up the examples, and I think that you'll see the variety, you know, the U.S. State Department, different than, say, a group at TED. And that's also different from LinkedIn. And they're not always corporate groups. I also am an active teacher who loves being in the classroom. I think honestly, what I'm trying to do is give everybody avenues for imagination and for connection to come alive, because technology is a medium, and it's a delivery that's meant to be, if we think of it as a vehicle, it's meant to take you from where you're at to somewhere else. And even your brief introduction to the podcast, I think I hadn't heard that, you know, just this idea in my head. I was thinking, oh yeah, everybody needs to be met where they're at and given an invitation to maybe imagine and play and see something different in themselves that can come out. So that's what I'm looking to do with everything I create, whether it's in a physical environment or in a spatial virtual one.
Nice. Now, How does that kind of interplay? I know technology's kind of gotten almost a dirty reputation for just not being good for people's health and well-being. Like, you've got the CEOs of social media company being grilled by politicians and by the media. But at the same time, what kind of things, especially when we look more into the future with advancing technology that blows my mind away, can we build so that it is healthy for us and improves our well-being?
You know, what I'd love to do with our conversation is get a little bit meta here, because we happen to be recording this as it's about a few days before a book that I'm writing is coming into fruition. So I'm in the drafting stage. It's due in a few days. And the book is about digital well-being. So
nice. You
know, for listeners, you know, here we are, Dave and I are having this conversation. And at the same time, I'm thinking deeply about intention. And I get to hear a lot of jokes from people as I share, oh, I'm writing about digital well-being. People will say things like, isn't that a paradox? Or isn't that an oxymoron? How can you have the technology and the wellness? And I laugh about it too, because I think that, sometimes I remind people, we're not in nature, we are nature. Like, we are biological.
Right.
And technology has many, many things that can be symbolically biological. And so I think that there are some connections there where we can make metaphors and we can understand sometimes the way that technology works as, now moving more toward a distributed network. And without getting too detailed, we can dive deeper. But I think that people right now are grappling with not wanting to internalize shame over their habits with technology, and also embrace that there could be a digital well-being kind of fusion of new ways of approaching something that in the past, I think the story of the past was that, oh, tech is foreign. Tech is something that might be vying for our attention. And then now it's also the villain to blame when things go wrong, you know, but then, you know, I mentioned shame. People are also thinking, oh, my habits are not great with the way I use tech. So they expect a digital well-being conversation to be about do's and don'ts or what we need to avoid, or, you know, me prescribing a certain life plan that fits very much into a linear structure. And I like the storytelling. I like to reframe the question of digital well-being into one of openness and hope and deep integration, a connection between people stepping back and saying, what's my intention and where am I placing attention?
Right.
So,
wow.
So I feel like it's the perfect time to be questioning all of our assumptions and also maybe even reframing technology as part of us in a way. It's becoming part of us. And if we can see it as something that should be treated with consideration, but not always a fear or an either or proposition, then we become more mindful about what's inevitably going to become an integration. So
right.
That's my goal, is to bring up all these questions and not provide easy answers.
I love it. And we were both at the same conference there in Santa Clara, the Brain Capital Innovation Summit.
Yeah.
And when it comes to technology, I find that a lot of what people refer to is what's already out there. That's kind of their base versus what it could be. And at that conference that you spoke at there, it really did kind of open my eyes that a lot of what was happening was to kind of take the diagnostic things, the intake forms, and put them into an electronic version to speed up the health system or the education system. And then there were a few tech companies that presented something that had some therapeutic benefit to it and kind of a lot around the mindfulness and relaxation. And then there was a few, and only a few, that basically combined feedback and diagnostics with something therapeutic. And that is where I kind of see things going, that it would open things up, this combination. And it's not just the mindful part, thoughts or music or relaxation, but all sorts of other things that will stimulate the brain. And as you put it, this biological being that we are. What have you seen in the tech side of things that is this combination or possibilities that's out there?
I've seen so many interesting, on the tech side of things, there are stacks of the hardware, and the hardware is just an entry point. It's always shifting. So I think sometimes we say technology, and you and I might mean an experience that the tech provides. I'm really interested in that experience and the design of also the before and after of the engagement that people can have. So I've seen things that, you know, we talk about this being a brain podcast, and some of the technology that I'm really interested in involve liminal states of attachment to identity. I've been part of experiences where there's biofeedback inspiring some synesthesia, and some of it involves a lot of prep, because you're being your neurofeedback. If your neurofeedback is being monitored and managed, that can be an onboarding that for some people interrupts the experience. Sometimes the tech's really fluid, and it's kind of easy to drop into. And, you know, I've seen some experiences where people have an understanding of what it's like to be blind and to be listening to sounds and have the sounds be guiding them in a certain way to create their environments. And, you know, there have been so many examples of technology doing great things, and it has to do with what you said, that word openness. For me, I'm really interested in when it opens people's minds and maybe shakes up their expectations. And then, of course, it can be used to make life easier or, you know, kind of, I think about people optimizing your productivity or giving you right. a refreshing kind of break, and then you come back to the task at hand. I think that's really useful. So sometimes a lot of what I'm talking about could also be an experience like a workout experience or something where people are doing something with their body using the technology, and then they come back and they're able to work more efficiently because they've had a break from sitting at the same desk, staring at the same screen, just trying to force out a behavior pattern that is kind of outdated. And I'm going to look back and just ask you a question, because the Brain Capital Innovation Summit was really special for us to be there, because they were combining science and some of the traditional mindfulness applications, and then also talking about creativity. What made you want to be there? Like, what brought you there? And what's the before and after for you about where you've been attracted to exploring in the past 6 months?
A lot of my initial thoughts have always been around neurorehabilitation and kind of how that plays out in society to get people better. And whether it's a stroke, or a concussion, something pathological, all the way up the spectrum to performance. So where you have an Olympic athlete who needs to be able to sense through his feet, through his skis, react to all that movement going 100 miles per hour without losing that edge of a ski. And that's the split seconds, right? And then I'm like, that's the same pathways that's involved with somebody who's had a stroke or somebody who has sensory delays, say in autism. And the world of neurology and brain capital and all of these are just so impactful in society. And as they mentioned at the summit, this is affecting more people than diabetes, heart disease, and cancer, they were saying. And it just blows my mind at the limited amount of knowledge people have around it and what can be done. And then it also really opened my eyes, and this is why the discussions on mindfulness is so important, and experience. And what you bring is that you can have all the technology in the world and it can make people better, but if the experience sucks, they're not using it.
It's true. It's going to say collecting dust. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And we've seen that with so many great innovations over the years that it really is amazing that we're getting the full picture of experience and experience with being healthier and with well-being. And I don't think well-being should be a swear word or prevention. And it sort of has been.
And it doesn't need to come after a crisis. It doesn't.
Right.
As much as I like to, sometimes I like to untangle words that have become mainstream. So, you know, the book Mindful by Design, it came out of me teaching in a classroom and finding that some fellow teachers were saying, I don't have time for mindfulness. There's not time for that break that I need. So I wrote the book to integrate into the topics. So there are different chapters. I have it here. There are different chapters that are about things like biomimicry and ways to integrate that into a science course. Ways if you're teaching, say, in an English class, that you could have an exercise called Out of This World, where you pretend that you've dropped off of a spaceship and you're encountering this world for the first time. How does your brain and how does your storytelling, how do you explain what you see if you don't have the labels? So what I was looking at was, deconstructing the term, like mindfulness means to pay attention on purpose in the present moment without any judgment. Those are the four parts that Jon Kabat-Zinn had mapped out. And I was thinking myself about three A's of being aware of yourself and your surroundings and your inputs, and also aware of your inner kind of landscape of emotions. And if you're aware, you could add a second A of advancing, seeing that, okay, who I am is not static. And actually there's a lot of limiting beliefs maybe that I've carried through this non-judgment practice. I can kind of let that go and get curious instead. And then the third A in my mindfulness practice ended up being authenticity, that I tried to bring to leadership, to the classroom, to any environment. What does it mean when we kind of strip away all of that and just allow ourselves to see and be seen? So, for me, bringing that into digital well-being, it all ends up being part of the process of, I started out as a programmer, so I have a technology background.
Right.
And I felt, Dave, that this world is kind of inviting us right now to question, what does it mean to be human, and what does it mean to be in a tech-saturated landscape? I knew that, at least for me, happiness is not... It can be a goal for a lot of people, and I think that's great. We can have tools to be joyful, to feel fulfillment. There's also something to maybe a deeper happiness that has to do with rigor and comfort crushing and doing all those things that I think practices in mindfulness can actually facilitate people feeling like they've come alive in the world and
right.
Things become opportunities instead of feeling as if we are not in control, because ultimately we're not in control. But if everything is an opportunity to play and to have collaboration, this is where I think the brain wants those patterns to break so that we start to notice differences.
And I love that.
I think in a very nonlinear way. So our conversation is also very nonlinear.
Nonlinear. And that's how the brain works. And you mentioned that different states, from happiness to, that time management crunch, get it done type thing, or that overstimulation from too much screen time, and back to, okay, body being relaxed, mindful of things. Yeah. Now, with what you're doing, though, there's huge opportunity to change the state to help people get in this. You mentioned synesthesia, or combining different sensations with, say, learning math. And there are different states that the brain learns better in.
Yeah.
Or performs different tasks. Like, I remember being at a Tony Robbins event. And we're up on our feet, we're dancing, the music's going, and I'm like, yeah, but I need to learn how to sit down and get work done. How to relax, not how to be hyped up. And what sort of things, because people think of virtual reality and AR and all of this as just being more screen time, a bigger screen. But there's so much more into it. And you mentioned biological rhythms. How does this all play with different states, different moods, different feelings, and combining that with like boring tasks, like learning something you don't want to learn?
It's like the answer to life right here. Well, right? I think one of the quotes I love is Blaise Pascal, who says, "All human evil comes from man's inability to sit still in a room." if we can't sit still in a room, and maybe I don't mean by force, we've all been kind of told to, be good or sit still, and I like to play with that, but what does it mean to do what Pico Ayer and other writers talk about, this idea of inhabiting stillness, like the quality of the empty space between the notes, I ask students about this. I think, and you know, people I collaborate with, we all crave, I think, those moments just to drop in and be in a deeper presence. We need to feel safe. You know, we have a human need to be in community and also to deeply reflect. And I feel like that's been missing. So what does it mean to give our mind a chance to do what I call kind of sanding away the rough edges, just deeply inhabit something where there's no set purpose, where we need to perform. We don't have to perform. Like we are enough in this moment. And what comes up too is an appreciation. Like I think, oh yeah, what I'm doing right now is not recording the block of podcast. I'm actually present. Like this moment is all we get. So it's kind of this maybe a visceral appreciation and sensation for the quality of the air or the feeling in the sole of my foot. Or, you know, I have a lot of hacks to try to pull myself back to not just being still, but realizing in the stillness, there are these kind of hidden pulses and vibrations that start to come out that remind me, oh yeah, I'm alive. My brain, you know, it's also creating sensations for me to embody and inhabit. So how I choose to approach getting in the best state to perform or then do something is kind of attending like a gymnast will kind of squat down before they leap up. I think about, well, what do I really need to ground so that then I can do what I want to do and feel like I'm doing it not out of an external need, but out of an internal intrinsic motivation? Because the way that I perform the task then is going to be totally different from the way you would, because then I'm actually what some people call alignment. Then I'm actually aligned with what it means to be me. And also, you know what I mean? I think a lot of people are unwittingly living lives where they feel an expectation that's so heavy from the world that when there's a pure moment to get to really enjoy doing what they're doing, we overleap that. And if I can prime for that with a little bit of soulfulness or a quality of meditation that allows me to be there, then I start to see relationship. Like, oh wow, it's not just about me. Right. It's actually about Dave. Like how does Dave want me to be so that you can be free? You know what I mean? It becomes relational the way that I am in the world.
Definitely. And I think what you just described too is that inner confidence people are lacking. If we're so worried about the outside world, we forget about ourselves. And that's when things fall apart, is that the whole brain motion feelings is how we feel about ourselves and then the outside world. You described so many things there and so much about that state to kind of get into. But I look over at my phone and I'm like, this does the opposite for me. Mm-hmm. So how does this possibility with technologies now transfer from this healing modality world that's been around for thousands of years now into a tech-centric environment in our lives?
One thing that came up for me at the very end of that last topic is just that also if we hold loosely, sometimes the problems that are very important that we're grappling with, we find solutions. So it can be really healthy for learning states and the brain to invite that level of, not that it doesn't matter, but we're going to attend to ourselves first before we approach problem solving. And sometimes people have told me they come to deeper solutions because they let go a little bit and involve exercises. So I'm always infusing wonder into the equation. the phone could be a wonderful device. A lot of times it's not wonderful. It can feel, you know, and we can feel nervous if we don't know where it is. Sherry Turkle, you know, she's done a lot of great research about being alone together because we're all on our phones. And I interviewed someone recently for the book who has an application that provides a little speed bump reminder. So it's called Clear Space. And if you're on your phone for, you set the intention first and you say, I really only want to spend this amount of time in certain social apps, and then it'll remind you. But do it in a soft way so you get to decide. And I think there are two things here where I love to go into states of reverie and lose track of time. And that can be beautiful in a creative state of flow. With the flow of, let's say, doom scrolling or doing things where you lose track of time and it's sort of a repeat behavior that you don't want to have with your phone, it can be a really helpful thing to have those speed bumps and the almost that accountability partner in place. And I think more people are going to build in those practices, I think, where maybe the expectation, hopefully, culturally will change. It already kind of is. If I brought my phone to a dinner with you and I had it out on the table, that would be something really rude, you know, and it's not enough just to turn it over. Maybe we need to put it away and give ourselves healthy boundaries. I like to think about opt-in, like what am I choosing as I'm saying no to certain behaviors? What am I replacing it with? It's something really positive. So I'd love to have a quality conversation, you know, and I'm doing that in bits and pieces in this book about digital well-being. Like, well, if there's a lot of hope and a lot of wonder in the world, what are we focusing on as we design patterns? Because soon the physical device that we call a smartphone is going to transform into something more three-dimensional. That's going to be, it's already starting to be infused into our glasses. It's, you know, headsets are coming out, Apple Vision Pro, you know, and if we move into spatial computing, they say great design is invisible. So how are we going to make these choices even more mindfully when we don't have necessarily an external phone to hunch over?
Right.
Now setting up these, perfect right. time.
Now with these spatial computing, how does that even work? And does it work with our brain's kind of ability, or is it against it? I'm blown away. I want to hear more.
Well, here's a thought. I'm going to postulate it. See what you think about this. I think we have three spaces right now that our mind can focus on. We have our physical world around us and what's coming in. We have our imagination and the world of that quality. And then we have the space in spatial where we can connect and potentially share that with other people or be by ourselves in that space. And because that's also a fantastical world where all of the senses are basically external and being supplied to you, you might have artificial sound. You could in the future have artificial scent technology. That's already a thing with OVR and other companies. And I was talking about this a little bit with Mark Prensky, who's wonderful philosopher and education expert. He coined the phrase digital natives. And he was talking about this third space, like the physical space, your imagination space, and then the metaverse space with spatial technology. My concern stemming off of that is that people are going to have all of these confusions, kind of like, you know, it came up a little bit. It comes up all the time in different sci-fi. You know, how do we know that this reality is our reality and not metaverse reality? If I've been in a headset all morning and I come out, I might actually think that something's on the wall that I placed there in my spatial environment because my brain is interpreting everything as real.
Right.
And sometimes we have dreams that seem so real and, you know, we have trouble making that transfer. So I think we need a lot of transfer reminders in the future. Because even using the word real, if my brain believes it to be true, then it's actually, and I think this would be a great question for you. If my brain believes it to be true, am I rewiring parts of my brain that then transfer back to a physical environment? Do you have any evidence of that, about whether a brain retains some of what it's rewired in a non-physical world when it's making a transfer back?
I think we're basically always doing that. We're always rewiring it, learning constantly. But yeah, when it's that question, well, we've got examples of people on drug-induced trips that have similar experiences of, and then if they come back and things are still firing abnormally, they have delusions. And so we have seen that. And I think there will be a vulnerable population where that happens to them versus somebody who can shift from a fake version to reality. And yeah, we've seen that through the years just with television, that there's always kind of some of those kids out there that when they watch something fantasy-wise on TV, always take it into reality and start to think that that's part of the real world. And that can be very detrimental, but in some people, it would be a great experience that, yeah, you could all of a sudden, someone who's been unhappy and gets rewired to feel happiness, even though it's not there. What a blessing that would be.
And maybe it is there. A lot of people will think it doesn't count, or that it's something false if it's a simulation, or if it's something in a world that doesn't exist in physicality. But the experience is very true and very real, and the emotion is very real that people feel. So there's no I lead some experiences where I frame a hero's journey where the circle back to the ordinary world ends up on a higher plane because people have a deeper understanding of themselves, maybe of others. And you can have experiences that are solitary and have this amazing transfer. Now you can also share things like share live experiences with other live humans as avatar embodiments from around the world. And your experience, mirror neurons are firing. You're with other people and you have this sensation and goosebumps and feelings of wonder. And I think what's really fascinating to me is that people can also maybe be more open and more, in my experience, they are more open to play and more open to states of flow when they're in an environment that's a metaverse or something simulated, because they kind of abandon disbelief and they go into this world and they're already kind of ready to embrace a new story and a new journey, and it's something exciting. So it seems to me that's probably why I'm attracted to it, because I felt drawn to lead these experiences that for people can be so positive and powerful.
Absolutely. And I think that once again is the important thing about the work you're doing and really bringing in different sensations with technology and the experience, the storytelling, and it's a different state. And if we think about it, like a lot of video games have put us in that state of arousal, that dopaminergic, that midbrain state, and violence or whatever. And that's gotten people away from going out and doing violent acts, that they seem to get that need met. And then the delusional person will take it too far. but the opposite now, we're diving into different parts of the brain that create that emotional state to feel good, to feel happy, to feel relaxed, to be embodied. And I think that's where people are drawing the conclusion from previous tech into what's possible, what's available, what could be there with other feelings and emotions. And you just tie that together and it blows my mind the avenues you're going, and a much longer discussion. So where do people find out about yourself, your books, and your future book to come out?
Well, I love all of this. And I would say also, just because gaming came up, that Stanford has great research, other places do, that violent gaming does not lead to violent behavior. So that was an artificial kind of concern that people carried, and destigmatizing the gaming world. I've been having a lot of discussions lately, what makes a game and how do we frame gaming techniques in ways that do more than spike dopamine and leave people feeling incomplete and like they have to keep wanting more. I think that trend in design is shifting, where it's become exposed and more people want meaningful games that can be, let's say they're about, they have well-being embedded in them. You know, I keep talking about integration, mindful by design, integrated into learning practices, gaming with high levels of engagement, great storytelling. You know, I have a whole list of 7 E's that you can consider when you're doing spatial game design, but you know, this idea of emotion and embodiment and entrainment, and you know, you and I could discuss this forever, but I think the point about gaming is that we have large communities who already love the medium, and it's time for the medium to become more mindful so that we don't, as you said at the very beginning of this episode, we don't need to have well-being or wellness as a side kind of prescription as much as an expectation. Of course, we're going to build games that have wellness embedded in the design, because that is what's going to make somebody want to come back and play more and see themselves on an upward spiral of then being the hero in the journey. So I'm really motivated in 2024 to keep being part of that meaningful game design that's going to have people feel engaged, but not feel like they come away, as older games have done, depleting us. You know, it needs to uplift us. So yeah, and I'm happy to talk about that more with you, with listeners, with everybody. We can do a part 2. As you know, I'm writing this book, Digital Wellbeing, and it really is a design book, an application book, a list of stories, you know, great for people in business and also people who are using best practices in learning. My name is Caitlin Krause, and people can find me at caitlinkrause.com and also on social, LinkedIn. I'm already, you know, just really into learning and community. So you and others are helping teach me, and we're kind of writing the story together. So I'm really grateful for that.
Nice. And when do you think the new book will be out? Because I definitely want to do a part 2 as well.
Wiley is the publisher. It'll be out in summer 2024. So nice. Yes, and let's do that. And I'm really looking forward to that.
Perfect. All right. So for everyone tuning in, definitely check out Caitlin Krause. And this summer, be ready for another amazing book to add to your list. And stay tuned to the next episode of The Hardy Brain, the show that takes athletic, introverted entrepreneurs and leaders and transforms them into ironclad brain performers. Take care.
Thank you.